On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, the deadline has begun. Josh Naylor on his way from the desert to the rainforest, going from the Diamondbacks to the Mariners. Is there a rainforest in Seattle? No, but there are forests and there's rain. So that felt appropriate. We have a special guest, co-founder of StockX, Josh Luber, will join us. We do the good, bad, ugly, and we make fun of a top draft pick for not being curious enough about maps. Hello, and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that believes that your trade proposal, that fake trade that you came up with, that's the perfect one. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And I would like to live in a timeline where all the fake trades happen somehow.
Yeah, you know, I know we became the latest outlet to put out some fake trades this week at Yahoo. And the reality is we are all so bad at this. All of us, both the people that are getting paid to talk about ball and those who have six followers on whatever social media account, none of us ever actually come up with the trades that are going to happen. However, the trade we are going to discuss today is not too much of a surprise, as the trades have indeed begun. Thank you, Jerry DePoto. Thank you, Mike Hazen, for giving us something to talk about on this Friday morning, Jake. And that is our opener.
Josh Naylor headed to the Seattle Mariners for a pair of pitching prospects, Ashton Izzy and Brandon Garcia. Don't worry, Jordan, we'll do 20 minutes on each of them in a little bit. I went to dinner last night at my favorite restaurant in the neighborhood. And I sat down at the bar, ordered a beer, had my headphones in, eating by myself. Wife's out of town. And blurp goes my phone. Josh Naylor to the Mariners. And it was so enjoyable to have such a ceremonial beginning to the hot stove trade deadline season. There was no kind of crawl into this. There was no, oh, is this the beginning? This is the start. Thank you to Jerry DePoto, the trader himself, for getting us going.
Yeah, and it's really appropriate. We know we can always count on Jerry for better or for worse. This is how the deadline began last year. Last year, it was also the Thursday night before the deadline. Now, that was a little bit closer to the deadline because it was a Tuesday and not a Thursday like this year. But the Randy Arozarena trade was the first big one and ended up being one of the biggest ones, if not the biggest one of the whole deadline last year. Now, that was, I remember, like past midnight when that news broke. This at least gave us a little bit more time to process before we went to sleep. But yes, this move does signify that the beginning of this very, very fun week that we have in front of us. And it is it's a big one. And I think that as Seattle did, you know, a year ago with the Randy deal, I think that they're looking at a lack of impact hitters available. They view it as a clear need on their team still in some form. Now, there were debates about what position they were going to be trying to fill, whether it was going to be first, whether it was going to be third. And it sounds like they're still going after Gino to some degree. They were like, why wait? Like, we had the prospects to get this done. It does seem like the Diamondbacks are prioritizing getting pitching back in these trades, at least in the early going. We know they have some more deals to potentially make. And so they put together a package that the D-backs were willing to take a whole week before the deadline. And I think you got to credit to them for getting something done this quickly. And by the way, you mentioned just a little blurb on your phone. We got an all caps breaking. Now, I do wonder if Jeff would have given this an all caps breaking if this was more kind of in the rhythm of the rest of the deadline. But with it being the first one, I think it was totally appropriate.
Now, Josh Naylor isn't going to win an MVP awards. He was an all-star last year. This year, the numbers are a little bit down. He's traded some power for some contact. He only has 11 home runs. Last year, hit 31. But he immediately becomes one of the best five hitters in this Mariners lineup and comes at a relatively affordable price with two pitching prospects, one of whom is in high A and one of whom is a reliever.
Yeah. And I think that, like, Josh Naylor, as we talk about, and this will be relevant when we talk about Suarez too, like, all of these hitters that are going to get traded, at least the ones that we feel good about, are flawed in a certain sense. And, but Josh Naylor's floor is really high. And I think that that is really where the appeal comes in. Obviously, it's a rental situation, so it's not, you know, a long-term commitment. But when you look at him over the past 4 years, it's been rock solid. You know, the shape of the production has changed a little bit. But, you know, if you look at all the first basemen over the last four seasons, again, we're talking about a big sample size because he generally posts and hasn't had a lot of injuries since his very dramatic leg injury earlier in his career. He is not elite, but he is like right at the top of that second tier. You know, he's got a 121 WRC plus over the last four seasons. That is basically eighth among, you know, first basemen with 2,000 plate appearances. So he's not, you know, like a total game changer, but add him to a lineup that Seattle has right now, which is actually deeper than I think people realize. Now, it's a little imbalanced because of how lefty heavy it is outside of Randy and Julio starting to heat up, Cal having a historic season against left-handed pitching. I think there are still some concerns about how this lineup, especially the bottom half, is going to perform against left-handed pitching moving forward, and kind of gives maybe the sense that they still need another right-handed bat in some form. But Naylor makes a ton of sense, as you mentioned, makes a ton of contact, even if the power's down. He's not the kind of hitter that he looks like. And I think that's a really important thing to kind of recognize when you watch him. He does have juice, but he can really, really put the ball in play. And sometimes that results in a lot of double plays, but sometimes it results in a lot more like finesse hitting than you would expect for a guy that looks like Josh Naylor.
Cell phone companies love him because of all the rollovers. Here's how he fits on the roster, right? So he's going to move to first. First base has been Luke Rayleigh and Donovan Solano doing their best. Rayleigh, not a good defensive first baseman. He probably moves to the outfield, spends some time at DH. Do you think Solano gets pushed off the roster with this?
Yeah, so this is going to be the question, and we're going to get this roster move at some point today. We haven't seen it yet. But the Mariners are basically going to be trying to decide what kind of versatility they want to keep. Do they want to keep as much offensive upside on the roster, which would be keeping Rayleigh, keeping Canzone, who's had a really nice run in right field. And then maybe it's the time is over for Solano. But like I said, then you're really lacking any sort of right-handed element on the bench. So maybe they send down Miles Mastroboni and just trust Williamson and you know, Dylan Moore to be the full utility guys. There's a few options here. My instinct is that it's kind of the end for Solano, but I'm not totally sure. But I do think that, like, Josh Naylor is an everyday first baseman, and I have to imagine that's how they're viewing him. So everything is going to have to fit around that reality.
Now, Naylor, I would say not the most electrifying hitter, right? It's a lot of contact, not as many big swings as you probably expect, like you said, given his size. But he is a fascinating character in terms of the intensity that he brings to the game. He got into it with Gerrit Cole, remember, during the playoffs a couple years ago when he did the Rock the Baby, which I believe he had been doing all the time. And then now whenever he goes to Yankee Stadium, he gets booed, which is just... Do Yankees fans have a Google Doc somewhere that they share with each other where it's like, here are the guys we boo? Because Naylor's kind of a deep cut.
Yeah, I would say, though, and, you know, in the case of Yankees fans, yeah, you give them a reason at any point, they're not going to forget it. But it's interesting you mention that because I know Naylor has had some high profile, high intensity moments, whether it's, you know, hitting himself on the head with his bat when he's rounding the bases after he gets a home run, spiking the bat and all these things. Like, he has not done that really at all over the last couple years, even last year during Cleveland's big run. Like, it's been much more toned down. Now, I don't want to read too much into that, whether that's a personal change choice to react because of how people were treating him. Like, I don't know. I don't want to psychoanalyze Josh Naylor too much, but the reality is that has not been the persona that has really been there over the last two seasons. And he's really been all business. Like, the dude shows up and the dude hits. He basically was exactly what Arizona asked him to do. And you have to give him credit to that, right? He's going to be a free agent. He understands that this is, he's been in these postseason races too, you know, with Cleveland. And so he'll fit in that sense. And I trust him to kind of show up. He's a flawed hitter. You know, there's ways where he can kind of go cold, but for the most part, I think he just fits for the Mariners for a lot of reasons, again, because of that floor and because of the fact that the lineup is in a better place overall. It looks a lot better to add a guy like him.
It's also a very interesting data point for the deadline as a whole, because with DePoto and the Mariners jumping the market a little bit, it can act a little bit separately from some of the other trades that we get over the next couple of days. It's both a market setter and something of an outlier when all is said and done, would be my guess. As far as the price here, how would you evaluate the package Arizona gets back?
Yeah, so it sounds like Brandon Garcia is someone that teams have been calling about since last deadline. This is another classic, just Mariners pulling a potential solid big leaguer out of absolutely nowhere. This is a guy who started his college career at Quinnipiac and like not pitching well. but he's a big lefty, big sturdy lefty who clearly has had stuff and that stuff has ticked up. He transferred to Texas A&M, still wasn't throwing very many strikes, goes in the 11th round. And then, you know, Seattle pitching development has just been cooking, obviously. And they've turned him into a really, really impressive, imposing left-hander. Now, he was being developed as a starter until this season. It seemed like Seattle was going to really use him in a relief role in the second half. Now they use him in a trade. I still think Seattle needs more bullpen help. Is Garcia a reliever right now? Yes. I wouldn't be shocked if Arizona tries to kind of get him back into a rotation role. Maybe that doesn't happen this year, but he makes a ton of sense for them just because, again, he's reached the big league, just reached the big leagues this week. He's right there. It's a lefty arm with the kind of stuff you just don't have in the minor leagues. There's some refinement that has to happen, but Arizona needs innings in all forms, whether that's this year, whether that's next year, whether that's years to go. That makes a ton of sense. And then Izzy is a much longer term situation. This is a guy who was known out of the drafts in 2022 because of his high school teammate, Noah Schultz, who ended up, you know, going really early to the White Sox. They were both pitching at a high school in Chicago. Schultz has obviously had a much more prominent prospect trajectory, but Izzy, even though his stats are not overwhelming, he's still only an A ball, but he's trending in the right direction. Now, he's still a couple years away, but that's more of a long-term bet, but another guy who you could see being a starting pitcher if it clicks. So again, seems like Arizona needs pitching, and it's not surprising these are the guys they landed on.
And it's confirmation of what we talked about earlier this week on the show, previewing the deadline, that Arizona is going to be one of the main characters here. Now, just because they traded Naylor doesn't mean that everyone's going to go. However, making a move on the earlier end lessens the logistical lift of trading everybody away. We talked about this last year at the deadline when the Marlins dealt away their whole roster, essentially. It's not easy to complete a trade. And it takes time. It takes phone calls. It takes manpower. It takes energy, all that stuff, right? And so to get Naylor out of the way early allows Arizona to kind of focus on the other pieces, Gino Suarez, Zach Gallen, and Merrill Kelly. Of those three, how many of them do you think end up going?
Man, it's so hard because we just keep talking about Gallen and he just keeps giving up home runs. And I'm just like, I just don't know what teams are going to be willing to pay for them. At the same time, I do think that sometimes it takes one good start. And I'm not sure exactly when Gallen is supposed to start again, if he has one more start or presumably only one more start before the deadline. But sometimes all it takes is just that right timing. And maybe Merrill Kelly, it's the same thing. I mean, Suarez is the one that obviously we've had big names, but this just feels unique where Suarez is at because, and again, now it's only more so because Naylor's off the board. How many teams seem to be that desperate to get him, even though he is also a rental? And even though, again, I love Gino as much as anyone, this is a hitter who just a year ago, like he was horrible for the first 3 months last season, like truly, truly bad. He goes off in the second half, and we know what he's been doing the first half of this year. But with his defense regressing, like that's another player that is flawed. And if that offense starts to go in the other direction, I mean, imagine if the Yankees get Gino Suarez, and again, seems like the perfect fit, but do the Yankees need home runs right now? Is that what they need?
Yeah,
like,
always,
yes,
brother.
Gino Suarez. Yeah, like, could, like, of course, I get it. Like, this version of Gino Suarez would make the Yankees lineup if not, it's arguably already is one of the best in the league, but would be, wow, oh my gosh, you know, that's a lot to deal with. But that's not the Yankees' issue right now, as we know. So I'm not saying they shouldn't go after him, but that would be an interesting fit. Either way, as you say, I think Suarez and those pitchers, we'll see if some of those other pitchers end up moving. The D-backs are just kind of trying to decide, are we going to get more for them now? Are we better off just keeping them, giving them the QO? These are the decisions that they're going to have to make.
Gallen pitching on Sunday in Pittsburgh. That is the perfect opportunity to pump up the value, right?
Hey, however, buckles however, are hot, though. Don't, careful what you wish for.
If you get swirlied by the Pirates, that is a high-risk, high-reward outing for the Arizona Diamondbacks. One last thought on the Mariners here. I think it's interesting that they make the first aggressive move of the deadline, considering where they're at in the American League and the state of the American League playoff picture. They're five games out in the division behind the Astros, who, despite looking like a infirmary tent, continue to win baseball games. The Mariners are in the second wildcard spot, a half game up on the Red Sox for the third spot. And then I guess that's two games up on Tampa Bay and Texas, right? The American League playoff picture is wide open. None of these teams are dominant. The Tigers falling apart recently has kind of confirmed that. The Yankees tumbling into oblivion has confirmed that. The Blue Jays now, I believe, have the best record in the American League. They do at 61-42. There is no dominant team, and that means, you know, it's open. And good for Seattle for being willing to run through the door that's been left ajar for them.
We just don't know when the American League is going to be this week again. And add in the context of the Mariners front office and, you know, how much job security does Sapoto have could certainly be debated. But I think that they still view this team as worthy contenders in this league at this time. And I agree. And I think that they should be continuing to act accordingly. And I think that would mean adding relievers. I think that while I think that they're clearly still, all sources indicate they're going to try to get Gino, and that would get their lineup back to more one of clearly the best in the American League. I think that adding to the bullpen, they tried to do it last year with Jimmy Garcia and it just didn't work out. They tried to do it with Gregory Santos. That really hasn't worked out. So I understand they might be a little gun shy, but at the same time, like, there are relievers out there that could make this a clear strength. They have a couple real dudes, and then it falls off so hard after that. But the pieces of a good bullpen are there, and I hope that they act accordingly. There are always relievers out there. Like, you can't go into a dead. There's no such thing as a deadline where it's like, well, there weren't any relievers out there. Like, that doesn't exist.
They exist.
I don't ever want to hear that. And so, this year particularly, it seems like there could be some real relievers available. Are they willing to pay those prices? They certainly have the pieces to do so. But that is what I am watching closely for Seattle over the next week, even more than the potential Gino reunion.
Before we take a break, are there any rumors, nuggets, buzz pieces that you've seen over the last 48 hours that made you raise your eyebrows?
Oh, just like broad trade deadline in general.
Yeah,
I think the Pirates are the other team that we're going to be watching closely. For all of these sellers, it's like, how far will they go? How many of their pieces?
When you say watching closely, you mean I don't have to like watch the games closely, right? I don't want to.
No, you don't have to
watch the Pirates games closely.
That's okay. But just again, that is the team. As with San Diego, I'm so confident there will be doing something weird that we're not expecting. But those sellers where it's like, okay, now that Arizona started, okay, how many of their rentals are they willing to give up? Baltimore, how many of those guys are going out? They have a ton of rentals. But then teams like Pittsburgh, teams like Miami, when you have the players that have multiple years of team control, you could get a ton, but are you willing to trade Mitch Keller? Are you willing to? I mean, the degree to which people are saying like Mitch Keller is one of the most likely to be traded at this point still kind of surprises me, but I do understand that they could get a lot for him. So those are the teams I think I just every day we get closer, I'm wondering about them. All right, we are going to go to break. When we return, we have an interview with Josh Luber, the co-founder of StockX, the founder of Ghostwrite, a new project he's going to tell us a little bit about with some great baseball card stories as well. We'll be right back on Baseball Card Friends. Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. We are now very excited to be joined by Josh Luber, the founder of StockX, Fanatics, Collectibles, and so much more, joining us to tell us about his new project. Josh, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Josh, we wanted to begin with a part of your lengthy resume that interests us in terms of the baseball card collecting. I know collecting is a pretty big space that we're going to certainly get into, but as people who, of course, have collected baseball cards, it's still something that I'm passionate about. How has that influenced kind of your whole career arc? Is it a big part of what has gotten you into what you do today?
This is the fun part. We could just come on and show each other our baseball cards and tell stories from, you know, when we were eight and got a first ripped off, first baseball card I ever got. I had to trade a box of Doritos for them because I didn't have any cards. So I had to steal Doritos from my mom's closet and take it to day camp and trade for a Milt Wilcox 83 Tops, which I didn't know that Milt Wilcox was garbage. You know, I was like, the guy convinced me it was a good player. I gave all my Doritos in my mom's closet. So, yeah, I mean, we all have the same story, right? We all grew up collecting cards during the junk wax era. We all had our cards sitting in our parents' basement for, you know, better part of two decades. And then depending on how smart and how much you foresaw the future, did you go get your cards in 2015, 16, 17, 18, or 19, right? And jump back into it. For me, it was like the end of 2017, beginning of 2018. It happened to be that we were running StockX at the time. StockX was starting to grow, and we were just trying to figure out what other products might make sense to put on onto the site. And trading cards were, you know, a really good product for a lot of different reasons. But so in a lot of ways, I was sort of lucky to come back to the hobby right at that time, like right before everything blew up, before COVID, before The Last Dance and all that. But like, you know, I mean, like I said, I have the same stories. I collected cards from 1983 to 1992 is probably the most important thing in my life.
And then now you're in a position where you've been very prominent in the space of collecting, and I'm sure you have quite a crazy collection at this point. Of all of the baseball cards that you have with you right now, are there any that stand out as a favorite, sentimental, particularly notable?
Yeah, you know, I've made a lot of really bad decisions collecting cards, like anyone. And you know, we all take our shots at different players at different times. But I made two really good decisions, which is that I went all in on Luka the summer after his rookie year, right before his second year, where he came back and went from rookie of the year to, you know, Hall of Famer. And I was buying Ohtani at the very beginning of his sort of like, he had his rookie year, he had a couple years off, he was injured, but like at the very beginning of him starting to come back and starting to get hot and people starting to look at it. And I made a lot of money buying Ohtani early, but I've bought and sold and sold off, but there's one card that I will probably hold on to forever. And the story about this is extraordinary. So, I'll show you the card first, and I don't know how well you guys know cards, but so this is the Bowman Chrome number to five autograph. So this is basically his second best card. The only card better is going to be the one of one, the Super Fractor. You know, it's a red jersey. It's a 10-10, so 10 autograph. And I mean, this is, I don't know what this would go for on the market. Maybe a million plus, like, I don't know. I paid $30,000 for it, but the story is even better, which is that, I was buying up Ohtanis at this time. I was a couple different card shows. I was buying all the biggest Ohtanis in the room, and I was just trying to accumulate them. And I met a kid who, was this sort of like typical, like hustler kid who was just sort of like trying to help me find him. He'd call me up and, hey, this guy's got him. This guy. So he found the guy who owned this card, and the guy was in Hawaii. Now I live in Austin, Texas. And the guy in Hawaii we made a deal, but he refused to ship the card. He's like, you know, I was buying it for $30,000, which at the time was a fair market price, you know, maybe a couple bucks, you know, high. And he says, listen, this is more money I've ever made in my entire life. I pulled it out of a pack. You know, he's like, I make $40,000 a year. He's like, I'm not sending this in the mail. He's like, the post office here steals stuff. I'm just not doing it. Well, I can't fly to Hawaii. And so there's this kid, this 23-year-old in the middle. I said, I'll pay you to fly to Hawaii. I'll pay for your vacation. Stay there as long as you want. I'll pay. You want to hang out there for a week? I'll pay for it. Get the card and fly it back to me. And he did. And I, you know, I covered everyone's costs and the whole thing. And the kid goes to Hawaii, spends like a weekend there, hangs out with the other kid there, you know, and then comes back and brings me the card. And there were actually two cards in the deal. It was this and an orange, which is numbered to 25, auto 1010. That one I've sold off. I made a ton of money on that. But so, you know, you figure out how to make it work. And this kid got a free trip to Hawaii out of it. So
I'm laughing about that kid going through airport security in like Honolulu.
And holding $50,000 like, in cash too, right? Because I had to give him cash to be able to go and buy it because, you know, it was a whole thing. And so, yeah.
Can you imagine? But man, hey. You're like on the plane, like clutching, you're like,
yeah,
like holding to it like it's the nuclear football.
You got it though. You got the Ohtani card. And it is funny though to think about like the Ohtani arc early in his career, because his rookie season, the novelty was amazing and he was amazing, but it was a fraction of what it was a couple years later. And I, as you mentioned, that kind of brief dip where we weren't sure if he was going to become this historic figure. Not that his rookie season wasn't already historic, but what it has obviously become over the last 5 years is a completely different level, which as you have, I'm sure, experienced financially, but also just in what that card kind of carries. It continues to get better and better.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There was a chance after his injuries that I was like, okay, it was a nice little, you know, blip as a rookie, and that was it. Then he started coming back. And look, the one thing that all collectors have learned is that if you have a card who has a market in Asia, there's just exponential returns, just because it's all supply and demand. It's just who has markets, right? I mean, Kobe, Steph, you know, these guys that have huge followings in Asia, you know, their cards are worth way more than the math of the supply and demand. And, you know, Ohtani, and it's a perfect microcosm of how the hobby works from a financial and business standpoint.
So before we get to your new project, the one other thing we did want to ask about, just you mentioned that early memory, I believe growing up in Philadelphia. What is your baseball fandom consist of at this point? What were the roots of it? Has it evolved over the years? We've seen a lot of pictures of you in Tigers hats. I know you spent a good amount of time in Michigan as well, due to some of the businesses and the work. So, yeah, I mean, where does it stand now? What does baseball fandom look like to Josh Luber right now?
Well, look, as you guys know, you know, that Tigers hat represents way more than just the team. And, you know, I was moving to Detroit to work with Dan Gilbert, who's the owner of the Cleveland Cavaliers and Quicken Loans and pretty much the entire city of Detroit. And outside of Dan's business ventures, his, you know, most important goal in life is the sort of reconstruction of the city of Detroit, and everything he's done has been for that. And so that was very much about sort of joining this team, the Dan Gilbert team and the people that I worked with and to sort of support that much more so than the Tigers himself. However, I never really had an AL team, so I kind of felt like that was okay. I never would have done that with a Mets hat if you know, if I was going to work with someone in New York. So I just would have had to sit quietly in the corner. But yeah, I mean, look, Philly fans are Philly fans for life, and you know, 93 World Series was the first time that we almost won something in my life, right? Like the Joe Carter walk off was the first taste of like, this is what being a Philly fan is really all about. And that was rough. And then the Sixers Lakers in 2001, where we won the first game and then got swept the next four. That was almost, so, you know, Philly fandom was rough all my childhood. And then 2008 was the first time that we ever won a championship in my lifetime. And, I was, you know, there was a rain delay in the last game of the series. And so I was home and we were going to go to that game. And then I forget all the details, but the short version was I had just gotten married And my wife and I were supposed to go on a vacation in Mexico with like her family and friends. And I was like, but you know, so I had to go. But streaming back then was not what it was. So I spent all, like for 2 days, I tried to figure out, how do I stream this game? How do I find somewhere to watch this game? There was nowhere in the whole city to go watch this game. And I ended up paying like a whole seasons of whatever it was to sit in the corner, you know, on my laptop to be able to watch the end of that game. But that was the first time we ever won anything, you know, as a Phillies fan. And so that 2008 team is, I mean, those guys are, you know, so, and then, so the last couple of years have been nice, right? Obviously, but it's just not the same. It's like, once you have that first win and growing up as a kid and whole thing, and it's hard to make my children, Philadelphia sports fans living in Austin, because in Philadelphia, you go to school, everywhere you go, like nobody talks about anything else.
Omnipresent.
Right? Like that's just 100, like there is no other conversation. And when football season's on, it's all about the Eagles. It's just different, you know, if you're not living there. So I don't know, typical Philadelphia.
My wife is not a big sports fan. And we were in Philly recently and like walking around the city. She's just like, everyone here is just wearing sports gear all the time.
Yeah.
In a way that you like, Pittsburgh's kind of like that too, where it's just people are just rocking stuff out and about. But Philly is easily number one. So Josh, you've been involved with a lot of different projects over your career, and you're now, you've kicked off something called Ghostwrite. Tell us a little bit about this project, what it means to you, and what it's all about.
Yeah, well, look, this is a blast to come and talk about Philly fandom and sports and baseball. And a lot of this is, you know, for me, I started a number of companies before StockX that had nothing to do with sneakers, nothing to do with trading cards, nothing to do with any sort of personal passions. And then it's either, you know, sort of fate or, you know, irony that the first time we start creating businesses around the things that I have personal interest in are the ones that become successful. After StockX, I created Fanatics Collectibles with Michael Rubin, right? We went out and acquired all the licenses for baseball, basketball, football cards and created that trading card entity where we essentially built that company from nothing, acquired those licenses out from under the incumbents. And look, there's a whole backstory there. And the short version is that it was my idea, but you know, it was 99%, you know, Ruben's relationship and ability of Fanatics to get those licenses. But what it did was it put me in a really interesting position of working with all the people that controlled the licenses for Major League Baseball and the NBA and MLB. And so when I left in 22, I knew that I wanted to create a collectible toy company. When you sort of look at all these categories, they're all the same. Sneakers, trading cards, toys, they're all what we call the hype economy products that are supply and demand driven, sort of at the intersection of culture and commerce. And so I knew I wanted to create a collectible toy brand, and I actually wasn't focused on sports. But then the people that I'd become close with at the NBA and at Major League Baseball, you know, I sort of just naturally told them what I was working on, and they're like, oh, we should make a baseball set. And I was like, oh yeah. Like, how did I not think of that first? Right. So it was such a perfect connection because Ghostwrite, which is a collectible toy brand, and I'm holding up what is a blank ghost. And I'll spare you the whole long story, but the short version is of all the collectible toys that exist, and collectible toys for any, it's, think of it as like starter art, right? You know, they're just pieces of art. Most toys are IP, it's characters. So think of Spider-Man, right? Iron Man, whatever, right? There's a lot of unique anime, stuff like that. But there's a few brands that are not, that are just what we call a blank canvas. And so this is what we call a ghost. And a ghost can be anything. It can be, you know, it can be a pencil. It can be an NBA basketball. And by having the ability to turn this into anything as a blank canvas, the closest thing you can describe this to is trading cards, because trading cards are the perfect blank canvas product in the entire world. The physical thing is the same every single time, but the value is about who's on it, right? Is it, you know, LeBron? Is it Acuna? Is it the backup, you know, catcher for it? The value changes wildly based on it, but the physical thing is the same every single time. And so how do we take all of that? How do we take all of the learnings and the scarcity and the demand creation in trading cards, which, by the way, you know, we didn't make any of this stuff up. You know, trading card companies have been doing this for, you know, 50, 70, 80, 100 years, right?
Since we were throwing them in bubble gum.
For sure, right? Topps started making cards in 1952. So, yeah. we didn't make this up, but what happened in, you know, in the last 15 years, but then really in the last 5 years, is the convergence of the rest of culture with the trading card industry and with that idea of how we create scarcity in value in collectibles, the true scarcity in value. Right. When you look at some of the cards today, like this Ohtani, which is numbered to five, there's only five of these that exist. There never will be any more. Right. This is it. Like the we understand the scarcity. And by the way, even the grading, we have full transparency into what the grades are of the other four of these. So we understand. So that level of transparency into the information about the products helps create the scarcity and the demand that understands the value. So how do we take all of that and apply it to an industry that's big enough to matter? The collectible toy industry has worked with all the most important brands and artists and companies in the world, but has never really had, you know, that connection with sports. And so we did the first one we launched was the WNBA set, which was in December. That one was perfect timing. It was coming at the end of Caitlin Clark's rookie year. I actually have with me one of the rare Caitlin Clark. So this one has a gold crown. So this one is numbered to 10. So this one, by the way, at this size, this sells for about $3,000 on eBay because it's numbered to 10. The one of one, just like trading cards, the one of one Caitlin Clark sold for $30,000 on the secondary market, this size, which is, you know, 2.5 inches for anyone that's listening. And so so it's just like trading cards. You open up a box, you hope that you're going to get Caitlin Clark, who is the best player in that set, but you also hope you're going to get the rare versions. And so for baseball, we're in the middle of launching the same thing. So here's actually, I opened up my first pack yesterday, and this is Aaron Judge. And this one is actually numbered to 50. By the way, we put on the bottom of every ghost exactly how many exist. So this says it's numbered to 50. But this one has an alternate face from the other players. So you can see it's sort of like, so here's Juan Soto. So Juan Soto has this very like stern face. We call this game face. This is kind of like, hey, we're super serious. And then on the right, this is called victory. So the victory face is numbered to 50. But it's just a way to create scarcity and a way to create. So there's different crowns for different scarcities. Number 25, number to 10, number to 5. Just like trading cards. None of this is the same. And so you open them up and you hope that you get Judge or Ohtani. And my understanding is I've heard some rumblings that there's going to be a $15,000 or $20,000 bounty on the Ohtani one of one. But no one's opened up any boxes. I opened up one last night in my room for the first one. And for the next like month, it'll be all marketing around this. And then the actual release will happen at the first week of August.
Well, we're looking forward to seeing. I know we've gotten a little peek at the list of some of the players that are in some of these packs. And I think that's something that certainly we are intrigued by. I think that's my last question for you how did you? I mean, of course, some of them are obvious, like Judge and Ohtani. But what was the process of settling on the players who was going to end up, you know, as the ones that are at the top of or that were going to be the most valuable?
Well, the it's interesting question because, you know, with trading cards, just the nature of how the physical product is, you can have every one in the set. And, you know, actually baseball cards were at the point where there's about 50 different trading card sets every year that have all the same players in it. We don't have that luxury, the physical nature of a toy and the size. So there's 20 different people in the set. I've started a thing that, again, a page we took from trading cards where we have one famous fan in the set. So there's 19 players and one famous fan. In the WNBA set, that famous fan was Aubrey Plaza, who's the actress and comedian who's a big WNBA fan. And for baseball, we ended up using Mark Wahlberg, which was pretty cool. Mark Wahlberg actually happens to be an investor in the company, an investor in StockX, but being a huge Red Sox fan. Here's Wahlberg. He gets to wear sunglasses in his Sox jersey and Red Sox in the back. But after that, you know, it's got all the stars you would expect. You know, Ohtani, Judge, Acuna, you know, Soto, J-Rod. But then we also wanted to have some rookies in it. And so one of the cool things about, again, just copying how trading cards work, like here on the Caitlin Clark, you can see there's an R on the side. So this represents this is a rookie. So this is her first year. So we had to put some, we wanted to put some rookies in the set. So we were good. We chose Roman Anthony and he goes and gets called up almost immediately. Roki Sasaki, you know, just obviously, again, sort of understanding the Asian market. So here's Roki. He gets the white jersey. Ohtani's in the dark jersey. And then Max Clark, prospect for the Tigers. You know, this, frankly, this is the benefit of getting to run your own company. Max Clark is a guy who happened to meet during a senior year of high school through some mutual friends and was just like a sweetheart of a kid, and like couldn't like be a nicer kid.
Oh, yeah.
And then he gets drafted by the Tigers, and I was like, oh, we need a rookie. Let's put in Max Clark. So it's great. So so here's the Max Clark one, and so those are our main three rookies in the set. So we'll see how it goes, but it's a blast.
Awesome. Well, yeah, Max Clark is perfect for. I would just have Max Clark promote literally anything I have involved with because he is the best. that is a natural partnership, especially with him ending up on the Tigers. Right. Josh, thank you so much for taking some time to join us and tell us about this new project. We really appreciate it. And good luck with the launch. And we look forward to seeing these ghosts around soon.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it. Good talking.
Welcome back to Baseball Barbcast. Let's hop right in to the good, the bad, and the ugly. One thing good, one thing bad, one thing Dan Ugla-esque from the week that was. I'll kick you the rock, Jordan. You go first. What's good for you?
Spencer Jones. Now, things are not super awesome in Yankee world. But Spencer Jones is on one hell of a heater. He was promoted to AAA. This is their top prospect outfielder who is very tall and hits home runs. Does that sound familiar? He was their first round pick a few years ago out of Vanderbilt, and he has had an interesting prospect trajectory as someone who is just doing his best Aaron Judge impression. But last year, the strikeouts got a little out of control. He struck out like 37% of the time at AA, and that really cooled the degree to which people were like, this guy is a no doubt, you know, future star. This year, he started to dial in. He's still striking out a lot, but he was promoted to AAA a couple weeks ago, and he has 13 home runs in his first 19 AAA games, including three in the first five innings, I believe, yesterday. So Spencer is someone we are a big fan of as a player and certainly as a person, as we've kind of chopped it up with him at the Futures game over the last couple years. But this is now just heading towards another interesting Yankees second half subplot. This is in my good because 13 homers in 19 games is with a 1400 OPS is good. But I still don't really know how good I'm supposed to expect Spencer Jones to be. And I think the Yankees probably feel the same way. But at this point, him not being in the big leagues at some point in the second half would be weird. So I'm curious how this kind of goes about.
I have a couple thoughts here as someone who thinks a lot about Spencer Jones. One, Yankees should absolutely trade him at this deadline. Like 100%. I hope Spencer Jones gets to have a long big league career. If he wants it to be with the Yankees, I hope that that happens. However, his value is never going to be higher than it is right now. Him hitting 13 home runs in 19 games right in front of the deadline when the Yankees have holes to fill, just go. Just do it right now.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned that he's doing his best Aaron Judge impression. That is more recent from a mechanical standpoint than you might realize. Now, Judge is a righty. Jones is a lefty. Only over the last like year or and change has Jones kind of fully adopted the Judge swing, the teacher man style, back hip load, one leg type deal. The stance is incredibly ugly looking. Like it is not fluid. And if it looks like someone who hasn't played a lot of baseball, like when he stands there, but when he makes contact, holy freaking crap. And the one other important thing that's worth noting about Spencer Jones is that he can probably play a little bit of center, right? And I think that that gives him a slightly higher floor than what he's being given credit for.
Well, and this is why his fit on the Yankees, if that is to be, because I think your points about the deadline are totally valid, he's only played center. Now, I don't know what that means because so did Jason Dominguez, and he's like one of the worst left fielders I've ever seen. So I don't know how to project any Yankees defender at this point. So I think we can stay focused on the bat. But that's the other thing, as I say, oh, well, he's got to be up at some point. But like I also said about Suarez, the Yankees are not craving home runs right now. So right. That's why I think, to your point, trading him for something that they actually do need would make a lot of sense, even though you have to imagine there would be some level of fear that, like, oh my God, what if he is 60% of Aaron Judge? That's a hell of a hitter.
If it ends up Joey Gallo-ish, fine. That would be a win. I am doing everything in my power to not be totally out on Jason Dominguez because it is just a tough watch. I had a buddy text me and say, hey, is that just outfield Gary Sanchez? And I was like,
Okay, so I have been wanting to have like a Dominguez conversation for a while. We're not going to do it today, but we should soon, because Gary Sanchez is an interesting, that's an interesting point. Gary Sanchez also was hitting a lot before it went bad. And the way that people talk about Dominguez as if he has 1,000 plate appearances of 120 OPS plus hitting is bizarre to me. And when you consider the fact that he stinks on defense, it's just like, I have no clue what his trade value is right now, whether or not they want to trade him or not. I just have no sense. So much of the focus has been on Volpe, and I get that, the Dominguez discourse has kind of moved to the side, and I'm fascinated as to like what in the world I'm supposed to expect from him, what the Yankees are supposed to expect from him, how high they still are. Anyway, we're already doing more than we should on this, but the Yankees outfield is also a fascinating situation.
He's a league average hitter who needs a GPS in the outfield.
Generous. What is your good?
My good is Jesse Chavez, who has officially, allegedly hung them up. He announced over on foul territory a couple days ago that his 18-year big league career is coming to an end. He made 4 appearances for the Braves this season. Do I think that he's actually done? Honestly, yes. I watched the video of him talking about retiring, and it sounded real to me. What a freaking run for a player who is drafted in the 42nd round of the 2002 MLB draft. Not just a round that no longer exists anymore, but a round that has not existed for a really long time. Right, like the draft is 20 rounds now, and I believe it moved from 50 to 40 like in 2011-ish. So just an improbable career for a dude who grew up in California. He finishes with 1,142 innings, 657 games, 85 of which he started, and a very respectable 4.27 career ERA. So a big huzzah and a farewell to Jesse Chavez, who, by the way, like last year, 63 innings, 1.34 ERA plus. Like, he was effective and valuable 12 months ago. What a run. What a player.
Yeah. Hell of a career. I will say, my only takeaway on this is, I feel like we're getting a retirement on foul territory like every week. And now I'm just going to be afraid when I see them post like who's going to be on. Like, are they retiring?
Bryce Harper on foul territory?
Right. I'm like, oh no. Oh God. But please. I hope this doesn't signal the end. Anyway, yes. Good. Enjoy retirement.
I also, actually, it is funny because if the player is coming on, you can almost probably tell in advance. It's like, I don't think Jesse Chavez is coming on to talk about his pitch mix. You know, I don't think Whit Merrifield's coming on to chat about how the salary cap's bad. Like, and then obviously, like, AJ and all those other dudes know that the retirement announcement is coming because, like, duh. And then they have to be like, whoa, you announced that here right now? Yeah, amazing.
This is where you come. This is where you come to retire. This is pretty
funny.
Should
have regular adults. They should have regular adults announce their retirements. Like, yes, I worked at this accounting firm for 28 years, and now I'm going on foul territory. Oh, Todd Frazier's like, you're retiring? No way!
Oh, my God. That's crazy. Jim from Boca Raton has decided to hang up the keyboard.
What a run.
He's moving on to spending more time with his family. What a run.
Really enjoyed that time we spent together on the Rangers, Jim from Boca Raton.
All right. My bad this week is the Detroit Tigers? Question mark. GMAC Cash, we might need a new version of your song called Tigers Lost Again, as they have lost 10 of 11. And obviously, when you lose 10 of 11, like, the stats aren't going to be great. But my God, are they bad. They are far and away the worst hitting team in baseball over that stretch. They're hitting as a team 213, 284, 321. Over those games. And do you want to guess what their ERA is? magic.
702.
No, nailed it. 709, which is more than a full run worse than the Atlanta Braves, who have sucked the whole season. Anyway, this is really quite the fall for the team that looked like one of the best teams in baseball for the first half. And now they just look like just absolute crap. Now, how much has that actually impacted their playoff odds or their chance? I'm actually curious about this. How much do we think their odds to win the AL Central have been hurt? Okay. they have gone from, they were as high as 99% to win the AL Central on July 10th. They are now down to 92%. However, their playoff odds remain at 96 and they still are in comfortable position. That said, 8 games ahead of Cleveland, but they're bad right now. So they're in bad because they look bad. They're playing bad, and they're bad. So Tigers lost again. Tigers lost again.
Kate Anderson. This is my bad. Kate Anderson, not bad. Kate Anderson, probably good. Even more good that the Mariners were able to get him with the third overall pick. He went and did his, "Hello, I am Kate Anderson. I work here now," press conference in Seattle. And he said during this press conference that he had no idea where Seattle was when he got drafted. This is from the Marine Layer Pod on Twitter. This is actually bad and good. The more I thought about it, the more good I think it is. It is bad because you should know where the big American cities are, even if you're from Louisiana, right? Like, if you gave me a map, I could point to Baton Rouge, you know? And I think that at a minimum, you should be able to point on a map to where all the big league cities are. If you are that good at playing baseball. However, the reason it's good is because this is a man who had no backup plan, it appears, right? like he knew he was good at pitching and this was his path. And like, I'm very happy and he's good, because not knowing where Seattle is as a 21-year-old is, that's bad. He's good enough to make it good.
I think the only thing I would say, I think your takeaway is similar to the one many people have had. To me, and I've just learned this as an adult and just like meeting, like, this is less about like, man, oh, what are they teaching them in Louisiana? What kind of education is this kid? It's like, this is more of a reminder. The thing that is bad to me that I will just not understand, and this applies to so many things in life, is the lack of curiosity. It does not compute with me. And this is, again, easy for me. Maybe I'm a total loser that I spend as much time as I do on Google Maps, let alone just like looking anything up. But like, I can't relate to not one, because it's not like he didn't know that Seattle was a place. And you would think that in, you know, the last couple months when he's having meetings with these teams that could draft him, he would maybe be like, where's Seattle? You know, maybe just look that up. Like, to me, it's less about that he didn't know. It's more that he didn't think to try and find out.
Yes.
I'm not a referendum of the Louisiana school system. It's just like, you can figure, it's really, really easy. How do you not have like the 40 years of like, ago? I wonder where it is.
40 years ago, he has to go to the library and break open the atlas. He doesn't have to do that anymore. It's in his pocket. And for you and I, whenever we learn about a baseball player in college or in high school, the first thing we do is Google map their high school. Like, like Kate Anderson is from Slidell, Louisiana. And I know that Slidell, maybe I should know how to pronounce it, and I'm the real idiot. I know that it is outside of New Orleans on the north side of the lake. Okay? Because we're freaks. Maybe we're the problem. Maybe we're bad.
I guess this is not meant to be like a holier than thou. It is literally I cannot comprehend the lack of just like, where, especially in Kate Anderson's position. But your points about like knowing where the major league cities are. Yeah. Yeah. But it's more rooted
Seattle
in just like, wouldn't you want to look it
near
up?
Me right now? Like, could I drive there?
Anyway, I will also say in Kate Anderson's defense, he's not alone. I promise you there are a lot of your favorite baseball players that don't know things that you think they should know. So let's just put that. All right.
There are a lot of baseball players who don't know things about baseball that you think they should know. I tell this story all the time. Not to out our pal, Lucas Giolito, who now knows ball. He now knows ball.
That's true.
Like, he has reached a point where he knows ball. When he got up with the Nats, not a man who knew ball. I remember him asking.
He didn't know ball at all.
He was a child. Yeah. He didn't know Paul Goldschmidt was. Remember that?
Yeah. 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 It's okay, Lucas. We still love you. All right. Ugla, you go first because we're finishing strong with my Ugla. But I love yours. Your Ugla was my backup Ugla. So go ahead.
Really?
Yeah.
Carlos Cortez is an outfielder with the Yolo County A's, who made his big league debut this week. He is 28 years old, originally drafted by the Nueva York Mets, ended up in the A's farm system this year in AAA, fought his way to the bigs. And what is fun about Carlos Cortez is that he is amphibious. He throws with both of his arms. He is not a pitcher, however. And so you might say, Jake, why he throw with both arms? Well, when he plays the infield, he plays a little second base. He'll throw with that right arm. And when he plays the outfield, he'll throw with that left arm. How fun is that? How ugly is that, huh?
It is wonderfully ugly. Unfortunately, he has not played the infield for quite some time. He did play it in the minors with the Mets. He has really basically only been outfield only. But it is interesting, too, because he's, functionally, you got to be right-handed to play, most of these infield positions. But as we just saw, he had a really impressive throw just last night, left-handed, right? From the outfield, from right field. And so what is actually the stronger? It seems like his left arm's actually stronger. He's a left-handed hitter. But he's just one of the stranger players. He's tiny. He's listed at 5'7".
He
had an awesome college career at South Carolina. Like, just a totally one-of-a-kind player.
Just to see bats left throws both. Great. No, no.
That's awesome. That is
Gerangelo.
All right.
Gerangelo, hang him up. You've been surpassed.
Actually, it's funny you mentioned that, because what is Gerangelo is listed as a switch hitter. I don't know how much hitting he was ever doing even in high school. But
I love the pitchers who are listed as switch hitters.
But listed as switch hitters. Yes, there are actually more than you think.
Like, Dylan
really
Bundy is a switch hitter.
Yes, yes. There are some weird ones. All right, let's finish strong. Jake, you know who hopefully is not going on foul territory anytime soon? Rich Hill. Now, I say that as a joke, because I feel like he probably has been on foul territory, but the next time he's on, I'm going to be terrified that this is the end. But for now, he rolls on as Rich Hill pitched for the Kansas City Royals, his 14th major league team, tying Edwin Jackson for the all-time record. Oldest pitcher in the big leagues since Jamie Moyer in 2012. Rich Hill, 45 years old. Jamie Moyer was 49. The Jamie Moyer thing is still not... That season still is not talked about enough as one of the more preposterous situations ever. But anyway, Rich Hill, this is incredible. It would have been one thing if this had happened on like April 20th or whatever. For him to keep grinding, he made like 11 minor league starts, hanging out with the Storm Chasers, and to make it up. And presumably, I mean, I don't know. Is he going to, has he already been sent back down? I haven't even seen. But the point is it's incredible. It's an absolutely ridiculous thing that he is still doing this. Is he going to get traded? Does he have one more awesome start in him that he could get to his 15th team? I don't know, but I would love to see it. And Rich Hill, he is ugly forever. However, I will also point out, just a reminder, folks, that Fernando Rodney is still pitching in the Intercounty Baseball League in Canada at the age of 48. So let's not forget that there is still someone pitching pro ball that is older than Rich Hill. And Fernando, who I believe recorded a perfect 1-2-3 save the other day for the Hamilton Cardinals, is still cooking as well. So double ugly for you today.
Rich Chill. Like, maybe he just doesn't have any other hobbies. You know?
I just don't know what he needs to see, because we keep enabling him. Teams are like, yeah, Rich, come keep throwing innings. As long as they keep saying that, he's going to keep showing up. So God bless, man. Keep on chucking the rock. But I, you know, at some point, someone's going to see. I'm not sure Rich Hill's going to come to the conclusion on his own at this point. So it's going to require the 30 teams to collude against Rich Hill to ensure that he can spend more time with his family.
That's what the lockout's going to be.
Here, Rich, Rich Hill. They're going to say, "Hey, Rich, here. Sorry, we don't have any innings, but I got you a spot on foul territory."
No, as far as I can tell, Rich Hill has never been on foul territory. So I really think we should be worried if we see him on it. Rich Hill, listen, if you're listening, Rich Hill, come on here. Don't announce your retirement. Just come on here just to kick
hang
it
out.
Okay.
No, dude, are you kidding me? Now I think scooping foul territory on a retirement is one of the great accomplishments you can do in baseball journalism. So I think that should actually be a goal. I know we're not in the scoop game. Just had Robert Murray on. We respect the insiders. Russ Dorsey, our colleague, he's grinding out there trying to get Jeff Passan, Rosenthal, all these guys, right? I think we need to focus on the retirement one and try to beat foul territory.
So I'm now looking at like veteran players who have not appeared in a game this year, right? Like, could we get Matt Moore? Maybe reliever Will Smith, Aaron Hicks. Did he announce his retirement?
Oh,
did we ever get a Bumgarner retirement announcement?
Is he still making money? All right, we're done. This podcast is over. But these jokes were good, I think.
Ooh, you know we got a chance on?
Yeah.
Travis d'Arnaud retirement announcement on Baseball Barbercast.
Okay.
That's our goal. I'm putting it on my vision board.
Okay. All right. Sounds good. We got some good ball coming up this weekend. Dodgers at Red Sox, Phillies at Yankees. You'll be seeing that. Mets at Giants, Blue Jays at Tigers. That's a 4-game set. Blue Jays already taken that first one because the Tigers lost again. Hall of Fame weekend in Cooperstown. Ichiro, CC Sabathia, Billy Wagner, D3 legend. And, of course, Dick Allen and Dave Parker being inducted.
You see CC? His car broke down on the way out. Did you see this picture?
I didn't. That's also...
Oh, dude, this was incredible. This is incredible.
Oh, I didn't see this.
CC, I assume, is driving from his house
in New Jersey to
Cooperstown. And the car broke down on Route 17 in the Poconos. And there is a photo of him and his entire family, like the whole Sabathia crew, on the side of the highway, mile 380.
We got one of the Sabathias with an awesome Griffey shirt. We got the oldest Sabathia. Wow, this is great. You know what the best part of this picture is? Is Amber working the phones trying to fix this. And CC's just like CC. Hitting him with the selfie.
So I have I've like been out to where this is because I'm a freako biker and I typed in where the mile is. See, Kate Anderson. Ready? Kate Anderson. I saw this picture and my first thought was, Where specifically is the Sabathia family stranded? Okay.
Dude, Rainbolt, again, Kate Anderson is the anti-Rainbolt, is basically what we've learned. he has no interest in finding out where anything is at any point. Exactly. This is more than enough information to figure out where they are.
You have the mile marker.
Yeah.
You know?
So how so far there, is this from Cooperstown, I guess is my question.
Pretty far.
Okay, so they got far. They got some work to do.
Yeah.
CC who posted he just posted, made it to Cooperstown. Y'all are some real ones to offer rides and everything. Much love. So it sounds like he made it. That was a couple hours later. But the point is, here's a question. Will this make it into his Hall of Fame speech? Are they going to edit this in to the speech that presumably he's already written? I guess we will find out. I am obviously looking forward to the Ichiro speech. I think everyone has been for years. So what that ends up being is going to be fascinating. But I think that's it. Any last things? I mean, we have to remind people about the deadline next week. But anything else before I finish on that, Jake?
No, sir. We have a live show. People should watch it.
Thursday, 6 p.m. is the deadline. 5:30 p.m. Eastern, we will be live on YouTube, on X, Facebook. Maybe we'll... I don't think you can live stream on Blue Sky, but we would if we could. But the point is, we hope you join us. How many more trades will happen before then? Probably a lot. But listen, every year, we get like more than 20... For the last 5 years, we have 20-plus deals on deadline day. So stuff will be happening, including possibly, hopefully, when we are recording. So join us. We are looking forward to it. But for now, enjoy the weekend. Thank you to Josh Luber for joining us as our special guest. Enjoy the weekend of ball. We will be back on Monday to recap it and probably talk about even more trades. Thank you, Andrew Hartz, for producing as always. You can email us at baseballbarbcast@gmail.com. We'll talk.